Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest this week is Steve Featherstone. He's a journalist and photographer who often writes for magazines, and he's recently been writing about the long-term aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster. He has a piece in the current issue of The New Republic titled Fukushima's Ghosts. Steve was on the program last year after he had written a feature piece for the New York Times magazine on synthetic marijuana in central New York. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Grant. Good to see you again.
Well, let's start with Fukushima itself. Can you provide us with a brief refresher of what happened there with the nuclear power plant and what's happened since the disaster?
Sure. So the disaster was caused by a earthquake, the fourth most powerful earthquake ever recorded in history and the most powerful ever recorded in Japan. That spawned a tsunami. The tsunami went up and down the northeast coast, killed 20,000 people. It also knocked out power to the Fukushima Daiichi 1 plant. And once you knock out power to the plant, they can't cool the fuel, fuel overheated, and four of the six reactors melted down.
And so what's happened since?
Well, a lot has happened since.
You could just give us the overview,
sure.
We'll dive into it
more
deeply.
Okay, so looking at the plant itself, what they have done is destabilize the plant. So all that melted nuclear fuel is still there, and they're basically trying to clean up the plant to keep radioactive contaminants from going into the ocean, which it still is. So that will be a decades-long project. It'll be going on for, you know, past 2050, estimates are. And if you look at the area around the plant that was contaminated, the residential areas, the farming areas, an area about the size of Connecticut, they are literally scraping the topsoil off, washing houses, streets, and whatnot to decontaminate it so that people can be moved back in that were evacuated 5 years ago.
And so the contamination in that sense then for the area went up in the air through what?
It
and
did.
Then came back down as some kind of precipitate.
Exactly. You think of it almost like an industrial a stack that sends pollution into the air. It goes up, weather carries it wherever it may go. In the case of Fukushima, the Japanese were very fortunate in some ways that the weather carried it over the course that it was, you know, emitting from the plant over the ocean. It didn't carry it over the Japanese mainland. And for just a couple of days, maybe just 2 or 3 days, weather patterns shifted and they sent a plume that was, you know, devastating in its own right over sort of in a northwest pattern over the mainland. And that was enough to cause the problems that we're seeing today.
So is it safer for the stuff to go into the ocean than it is on the land? I mean, why is that safer? I would think that would expose everybody.
Is
it dissipates more quickly? Is
exactly,
that what it is?
Yeah. So safer for us, maybe not so much for the fish, but even for the fish. This is one of the things that drew me to this story because I had been reporting on nuclear issues for a number of years. I went to Chernobyl a couple of times. And so you get to read about this stuff and you realize that a lot of what you see about nuclear contamination, radiation, is hyperbole, whether it's in the press, whether it's in popular culture, you know, people turning green and glowing, you know, gigantic fruits or people, right? Mutants, that kind of thing. It's a lot of hyperbole. So one of the things that I thought was interesting was that you'd see these graphs. I don't know if you saw them probably come across your email or maybe you'd see them online of like this plume, this deep red plume of radiation spreading across the ocean to the west coast of the United States and with alarming headlines like, it's coming to California, watch out. So I was looking into that and I thought, you know, I talked to a couple of scientists and what I learned was that, you know, the ocean is a big thing. It's a big place. And the contaminants that we're most concerned about, cesium and strontium, they're soluble. So they enter the ocean and they spread out. So they're diffused by the ocean.
Now, how do you go about on the land, cleaning something like that up? I mean, it seems like it would just be ubiquitous and almost impossible to tell us how you clean that up.
Okay, that's a great question. It is an immense project. We have something similar going on here in the United States up at Hanford, Washington, where I've also been. Hanford is the home of – it was part of the Manhattan Project. It's where we made plutonium for our plutonium bombs. They're doing this sort of the same thing there. So literally what you have to do is just mop it up. You can never get rid of radioactive contaminants. They don't disappear. You can't clean them. It's kind of a misnomer. you can only move them. So you scrape it off the land, you wash it off structures, you bundle it up in bags or barrels, and then you find a place to put it, bury it. And then now you've got other problems, political problems, but, well, it's NIMBY, right?
Right.
I don't want this stuff in my backyard. In Japan, if you want to know some of the details, it's kind of interesting. So in Japan, they dig down 2 inches around a 65-foot perimeter around every structure. So 65 feet out, 2 inches down, they take everything off, bushes, topsoil, everything. They put all in bags and they stack the bags up, and they still don't have a place to put all that stuff.
Okay. And so this leads directly into then something I want to ask you specifically about your piece in the magazine. Your piece in the New Republic strikes a very critical tone about the official rhetoric about the cleanup and the resettlement of the area. Do you think that this cleanup is sufficient to be letting people back in? I mean, you were comfortable enough to go there and spend several days, so I guess there was some level of safety you thought had been reached.
Yeah. I'm not probably the best baseline to use for that because, you know, I've been to Chernobyl a couple of times. I've actually been inside the Chernobyl plant. I've been inside the Fukushima plant, and I've come to maybe be a little less careful than I thought I should be. I remember one instance when I was in Fukushima. I was with a photographer who'd also I've been with in Chernobyl. We were up in one of the mountains, and they did not decontaminate the mountains at all. And the mountains are what sort of catch. They caught most of the radiation because they kind of act like a screen from wind. And the radiation levels up there were quite high. And I had no protections whatsoever. Me and my buddy, this photographer, were just going to go hiking in the mountain to get a good shot of the plant. That was our goal. We had no regard at all for the radiation. Then I thought, you know, maybe we should probably put some foot covers on and maybe take our shoes off before we get back in the car. So really, I mean, the radiation, I think for most people in the decontaminated areas that Japan is decontaminating now, these towns and cities, I think it is safe for them to move back. Now, that's an individual choice, and everybody that I spoke to would tell you that. Like, it's good for me, but maybe not so much for my neighbor who has kids.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with the journalist Steve Featherstone, and we're talking about his recent work on the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. What was the effect of this incident on nuclear power in Japan and around the world? What kind of repercussions?
Oh, it was immediate and chilling. Japan immediately shut down every one of its reactors. And even today, I think they've only restarted one or two. The Abe government in Japan is very keen on restarting the entire fleet. But the public opinion in Japan is very much against it. Worldwide, you saw a pretty profound chilling effect on new construction of reactors. In Germany, they announced a complete pullout. A sort of a phased pullout of nuclear power. Something similar happened in Italy. Construction starts in the really sort of in countries like China, which are really were pushing hard for new reactors. They put a halt on all new construction, and it didn't have much of effect here because the nuclear industry in the U.S. has been pretty moribund for the past couple of decades. There hasn't been a new start, a new construction, a new plant fired up in decades.
And as you write about this, the disaster was not simply the result of an act of nature. I mean, that's what precipitated it, obviously, the tsunami. But it also was man-made in part through negligence in terms of not thinking about what would happen if something like that were to come to pass. That's what I got from your piece.
Absolutely.
So what does that say, do you think, about the prospects for nuclear energy safety more generally?
Well, yeah. These are incredibly complex systems, nuclear reactors are incredibly complex. The concept is simple. It's simply just a big steam generator. We're boiling water to turn a steam turbine, which, you know, the old mills from 200 years ago were turning wheels to generate power, so to speak. Now these things, though, however, you've got to cool that fuel, and so you've got they're so complex that if one valve sticks and a gauge doesn't work or someone's not reading that gauge correctly, you get something like Three Mile Island. That was a combination of people looking at gauges and really not believing what they were seeing, and not trusting their judgment because these systems are so complex. And the new generation of nuclear energy, nuclear reactors. And this is something where it starts to get a little political because when we look at the reactor at Fukushima, it was a first-generation reactor. These are old reactors. These are the same reactors we see up here at Fitzgerald, Nine Mile, and Indian Point here in New York State. These are first-generation reactors. The new generation reactors are designed to basically almost take the human out of the loop so that if something goes wrong, there's passive systems that automatically go into place and they don't require – most importantly, they don't require electricity. They don't require power to cool the unit.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with journalist Steve Featherstone. He's recently written on the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster, including a feature piece in the New Republic titled Fukushima's Ghosts. Well, as you've mentioned, Steve, you've traveled to Chernobyl twice, and you've also been to Hanford, Washington, which was a place of other significant nuclear events. What did your visits there teach you, perhaps different than Fukushima or that reinforced some things that you got from Fukushima? Tell me about those visits there and what they taught you.
Well, Chernobyl, it's funny. I got I was a history major at school, and I think what drew me to those stories most was the history of the place, not so much the nuclear things. And I was really drawn by the fact that Chernobyl is still like this like a time capsule. It is literally sealed off. It was in 1986, and it is exactly like it was in the Cold War. You go there today. It looks like what every sort of Cold War poster that you can think of looks like. There's still all the artifacts, the Soviet artifacts there, and it's just frozen in time. That was fascinating for me as a history geek.
Now, a tourist, though, can't go in,
they
right?
They can, actually. Really? Oh. Yeah, they were running tours, bus tours. You can take a bus okay. tour, yeah. And it's you can't – I believe you can get off the bus. So they take you in, and they will take you right to the plant.
You sign a waiver before you go, I would say.
I think so. That's right. They'll take you right in there, and they'll drop you off. And you can stand in this parking lot and look out. And, in fact, I think you can actually get out in Pripyat, too, which is the big city – that was evacuated. It was an atomic city. It was purpose-built to service the reactors. You can get out and walk around a little bit, and then you get back in the bus. It's sort of a day trip. And I believe they're still running those tours. And I think there was some talk in Japan of some bus tours that go through Fukushima. Now, in Fukushima, you can actually drive. You can drive right through the center of the zone. You can't get out of your car. You can't go on side streets. But when I was there last, you can just literally rent a car and drive right into the zone and drive right by the plant. More or less, you know, within a couple of miles of it. It's pretty amazing when you think about it, and it's pretty spooky.
So let me bring you back to Chernobyl and Hanford then. I took you off the track a little bit, but what did you gather from those experiences?
Well, I think the thing I gathered is that there's no – nuclear is eternal. So it is absolutely eternal, and there's no – and I go back to something I said earlier in the conversation, which is you cannot – when we talk about cleaning up nuclear, there's a nuclear cleanup. That's a word that I try to avoid when I'm writing because you can't clean it up. You just move it around. And in fact, in one of the knocks against the nuclear industry today, and it's a well-deserved knock, is that all the material that's produced, the spent fuel, we have no place to put it. There is absolutely no place in the United States. In fact, I think there's maybe one place in the world that has a dedicated repository for spent nuclear fuel. And that's a big problem. You know, where is this stuff sitting? It's still, you know, it's still hazardous. I mean, highly hazardous. It could be a problem. It's a proliferation problem. It could be, you know, a terrorist might be able to slam a plane into maybe not a nuclear reactor, but what about one of these storage facilities, you know, where they store fuel?
And you mentioned the industry. Nuclear power does seem to occupy this odd place in our current discussions about clean energy alternatives and also about how to address the challenge of global warming. It's nuclear power, it seems to me, it's kind of Janus-faced, you know, in terms of how you look at it. So could you reflect a little bit on that?
Yeah. See, for me, it's strange because I consider myself sort of a green person, right? You know, I recycle and I do all that stuff. And I've been sort of trained, like probably most, people that nuclear bad, right? Nuclear energy is bad. It leads to disasters. And there's certainly lots of things wrong with it. But interestingly, at the last the climate accords in Paris this past late winter here, one of the leading climate scientists, James Hansen, he's the guy who is probably responsible more than anybody else in bringing global warming to public consciousness back in the 80s. He was working for NASA at the time, NASA's top climate scientist. James Hansen and three other top scientists came out and said, we can't ignore nuclear energy if we want to stop global warming. There's just no way you could ignore it. And this kind of caused a stir among the more staunch eco folks, you know, who are anti-nuclear, because you've got these top scientists saying we can't take this out of the equation. In fact, we really need to ramp it up.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Steve Featherstone. Well, you mentioned that in the United States there hasn't been any new nuclear activity, but I believe there was one recently that has started up by the Tennessee Valley Authority, and as you point out, it was the first one in decades, new reactor. So is this industry in the United States beginning some kind of comeback, or still moribund, do you think?
I think it's still moribund. I mean, the interesting thing about Watts Bar, which is the name of the reactor in Tennessee that just was fired up, is that was built in the 70s and 80s. That's an old reactor. So it's actually not new. It was built, it was commissioned back in the 70s and 80s, and then because of construction costs, and this is another an issue with the nuclear energy, is that it's incredibly expensive to build these things. And the cost, they looked at the cost and said, look, you know, we can't generate enough power to get our cost back on building this thing. So they just mothballed it. Now, now they've fired it up. Apparently they've done the figures and they said, well, maybe we can recoup our costs. So I don't think it's really a reflection that the U.S. industry is getting better. But I think that's going to change as people become a little more in tune to what global warming and climate change is going to do. I think you're going to see maybe not cost won't be the bottom line, right? Mm. I mean, hopefully people will be looking ahead and saying, look, this does cost a lot, but if it's going to, help offset carbon emissions, then let's do it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the economics of that, because even setting the safety and the worry about these incidents aside, there are economic challenges to nuclear power. And, right here, the Fitzpatrick plant in Oswego is closing. So
they're asking for money from the state, and they're constantly asking for money from the state to offset their costs, or else they can't keep operating. And that's probably true. I mean, in New York, maybe there's just maybe not a lot of demand. Also, fracking natural gas is really look at what's done to the oil industry. It's really tanked the oil industry, natural gas production. It's killed the nuclear energy. I shouldn't say killed. It's sort of taken the heat off the nuclear energy to the need to produce power from nuclear energy because of natural gas. But natural gas is a CO2 emitter.
Yeah, and the other thing about the natural gas that strikes me is those prices may not stay the way they are forever. And so when that picture changes, so the other question I wanted to ask you related to that is long term. What's your sense of the long-term prospects for nuclear power? It's sounding like you think down the road we may see more reactors. This may come back.
I think so, and they are. And in China, earlier in the conversation, you heard me say that they stopped construction. They've restarted. They've got 24 reactors now that they're building. They've got 30, about the same amount on the books. So if they're building 50 reactors here in the next decade or so. India has got 6 they're building, 30 more on the books. Well, that's a lot of reactors. But it's not enough to offset, according to James Hansen's figures. He figured that we would need to build about 100 reactors a year until 2050 if we're going to completely decarbonize electricity generation, okay? And that includes an increase in renewable energy too. That's a lot of reactors. And of course, you look at the safety figures. Let me throw this at you. I did a story for Popular Science a couple of years ago where an expert in the industry estimated, based on the number of accidents that we've had, when I say nuclear accidents, we're talking like Three Mile Island, Fukushima, that we can expect an accident every 6 years on that. Based on what we've already had in the current nuclear fleet, we can expect a similar accident every 6 years. If we're using the old technology, maybe. I think the new technology for nuclear reactors is much safer, as I mentioned before.
And question now about you and your writing, and I'm going to go back to our previous interview and link it to this one.
Sure.
So last time we talked about synthetic marijuana, and you got pretty deep into looking into that, which is very dangerous and also took you into some sketchy situations.
Parts of Syracuse I never knew existed.
Now you're on this horrible nuclear accident beat.
Right.
Are you some kind of thrill seeker in a strange sort of perverse way? What are you doing with your ride?
I'm not the smartest guy, I think, when it comes to like thinking about my safety. I worry about more about the plane ride over there. I'm a terrible flyer. So I'm more concerned as I'm shaking in my boots as I'm flying to Tokyo than I am when I get on the ground and I'm running around Chernobyl or Fukushima. I think it's because when you find a niche, there's no one else really writing about this kind of stuff in this kind of detail. The kind of stories I write, you know, they're not news stories. They're in depth, and I get to talk to a lot of people, and you know, and really scope out an issue. So, something like nuclear is the thing I like about it is there's a mystery at the heart of it. We really don't know what radiation does to people at low levels, at the levels that we're talking about people being exposed to in Fukushima and Chernobyl and Hanford and really around the world. We're being exposed to this stuff all the time. We really don't know what's happening. So it's kind of like I can write as much as I want and I'll never get an answer.
And you also took your piece in the New Republic in an interesting direction. We've got a couple minutes at the end. I wanted to explore it. It's much more complicated than what we'll have time for. But it was more a rumination about the Japanese culture and then how the relationship and the tension between individualism and community-oriented things play itself out in the decisions that people were making about whether to come back and resettle after they were opened up. It was fascinating in terms of the concern that people who didn't decide to relocate, you know, had about the people who did. Tell me a little bit about that. It's really interesting.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Grant, because to me that was by far the most interesting part. You know, I've been to these, you know, I've written about nuclear stuff for so long I could care less about the facts and figures anymore. But to be in a place where people are making life decisions about whether, you know, huge decisions about their lives, about where to live, where to raise their families, this was kind of what I wanted to get at. And so when I went to Fukushima, the first thing, of course, I had in my mind was I'm going to ask everybody about radiation. So the first week I was there, I was like, what do you think about the radiation? And you could just see their faces go blank, like they did not want to talk about that. Or in fact, they didn't want to talk about me. Japanese people are much more conservative, I guess, in a social situation than Americans are. And when you kind of pop out with a question like that, I learned quickly that you turn them right off. It turns out that, like, you know, radiation is the least of their concerns. The disaster had a huge, profound effect on social relations in that part of Japan. For instance, I think when I really was tipped off to this fact, it was people kept telling me like, well, you know, these are older people mainly are moving back. They're 50 and above. Some are elderly, 70s and 80s. And they said, I moved back because, you know, I've got no other place to go. And but my daughter-in-law does not want to move back here. And I think she's keeping the grandkids from me and she's blaming radiation on it. And I thought, boy, this is kind of a funny old coot. And I would keep listening. But I kept hearing this story over and over again. And I realized that the top concern wasn't the radiation. It was like how these families were broken up, these extended families, because especially in this part of Japan, these people have been living together for generations, like eight generations. Like they go way, way back and families are very, very tight. And the disaster just fractured this whole community.
That was Steve Featherstone, and you can find his latest work on Fukushima in the July-August edition of The New Republic. Steve, it's always a pleasure talking with
you. Thanks, Grant. Nice talking to you, too.
You've been listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.